This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today on the Jodcast, we have Professor Clement Pripe from the University of Minnesota.
Hi, Clem.
Hi.
Now, I'd just like to start how lucky we are to have interviewed Clem. Many of the listeners will probably have heard the news of the recent claim to detection of gravitational waves by BICEP2, and Clem is one of the principal investigators of BICEP2. You must be pretty proud of your achievement.
Yeah, it's been a long road.
So let's have a minute. So what is BICEP2, and how did you detect gravitational waves?
So BICEP2 is a small, highly specialized radio telescope which is located at the South Pole in Antarctica. And it was built to try and detect the signature of gravitational waves in the cosmic microwave background, which is kind of like an afterglow from the Big Bang.
And what were you looking for in the cosmic microwave background then? What tells you about gravitational waves?
So the theory says that there may be a very special imprint in the polarization pattern of the microwave background, imprinted on it 400,000 years after the beginning, after the Big Bang, by the presence of gravitational waves at that time. But these gravitational waves are hypothesized to come from the very, very tiny fraction of a second after the beginning. So really from that first instance of creation.
Brilliant. And so you're looking for this particular source of polarization. What makes BICEP2 particularly special to be able to do that, as opposed to previous experiments that have tried?
Well, basically because it's more sensitive. It was designed specifically to go after this signal and to go after it as aggressively and as quickly as possible. And so it's very, very sensitive, and it also has very good immunity to, you know, false signals that might arise from the ground or the atmosphere or whatever.
So this is based in the South Pole?
Yeah, it's actually located about 1 kilometer from the Earth's rotational axis in Antarctica, where there's quite a large science installation, science base, that's run by the U.S. National Science Foundation.
And why is it in the South Pole then?
So the reason it's one of the best locations on Earth for this kind of science is because the atmosphere there is incredibly dry. It's really very counterintuitive. When you get off the plane, you're standing on 10,000 feet thick of ice, but yet it's one of the driest places on Earth. And the reason for that is, of course, that the water hasn't melted there for millions of years.
Okay, brilliant. So you've got this highly sensitive experiment situated in the best place in the world to measure these beam modes. Where did you expect the gravitational waves to come from? What is the cause of these gravitational waves?
Right. So as I said, I mean, the specific goal that we went after was to detect gravitational waves that are hypothesized to have been generated, spawned, injected into the fabric of space in a tiny, tiny fraction of a second after the beginning. So at about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, right? So if you imagine dividing a second by 10, 35 times, that tiny, tiny fraction of a second after the beginning. The idea is there was this process called inflation, where the universe hyper-expanded, and that hyper-expansion will have injected into the fabric of space-time these gravitational waves. That's the signal that we went looking for, a theoretical prediction, but rather an uncertain theoretical prediction, right? The actual amount of such gravitational waves, the theorists refuse to say, right? They say, oh, well, it could be this big, but it could be a lot smaller, right? So in some ways, rather a foolish experimental mission to go on, right? Because could be, it's kind of like a wild goose chase, right? Except we actually seem to have found the goose, which is pretty amazing.
So gravitational waves were predicted by inflation. Why did people originally think of inflation as a model for the universe, the early universe?
So the inflation theory came about because it explains a bunch of things. It naturally explains a bunch of things which otherwise there's really no explanation for within, you know, any of the available theories or models. So it explains things like why the universe seems to have been very uniform at 400,000 years after the beginning. So when we look at the microwave background glow, we can see that the universe was almost uniform, uniform to within a fraction of a percent at that time. And the question is, how did it know to do that, right? How did it know to be the same temperature everywhere at that time? And what inflation does is it takes a subatomic volume of the pre-existing universe and it hyper-expands it, and so it makes the universe smooth and uniform, as the real universe appears to be.
Brilliant. So this is a theory which has been predicted for many years then, or is...
Yeah, it was first proposed in the 80s, and, you know, some people would consider that it's already proven, because, you know, it makes these predictions that appear to be true. It also made this additional prediction of gravitational waves, and that's partly why we weren't looking for them. But more than that, if you can actually find these gravitational waves, you can get information about the exact time that inflation occurred, i.e. the energy scale at which inflation occurred. And that's getting information about fundamental physics at an energy scale way beyond what you can reach with particle accelerators here on Earth. So it's fundamental physics at super high energies is what it is. And so that's what made this this result so exciting.
Brilliant. So it's almost like, well, I mean, up to this point, it's kind of been the holy grail of kind of modern cosmology to get this.
Yeah, holy grail, wild goose chase, whatever you want to call it. Yeah,
trying to find this.
I called it looking for a needle in a haystack and finding a crowbar, right? Because the signal's about as big as anybody could imagine it being.
So there was kind of controversy when the paper first came out about how large this signal was, because people had, I mean, Planck had predicted, had made a constraint which was smaller. Predicted value which was smaller than 0.1, and you found this kind of amplitude to be 0.2.
Yeah, it's not really a prediction from Planck. It is a measurement based on temperature data, and as you say, they were saying that it ought to be less than 0.1. Now, you know, there are a couple of things to say about that. One is the best fitting value that we've measured is of the signal that we've measured is 0.2. But there's a big so-called sample variance fluctuation on that. Basically, if you looked at another patch of sky, you might see 0.1, and it could be that the average value across the sky is 0.1, right? It's just in the little patch that we've looked at, the structure fluctuates up, right? It's bigger than average. So that's one thing to say. You shouldn't get over-fixated on that 0.2 number. The other thing is that there is a contribution in that 0.2 that comes from galactic dust emission. And it's unclear how big that contribution is. In the paper that we put out in March, it was looking like it was pretty small, maybe 10%, right? Pretty negligible. There's talk since that it may be larger, right?
Okay.
So it's unclear what that value of R is going to end up being. Or, you know, if in fact the dust polarization might end up explaining all of the signal, although that still seems to me relatively unlikely.
So why, since you've published this paper, has your perception of the dust changed?
Well, there's some actual published information from Planck now. They put out a paper on the polarization of dust at 350 gigahertz, so at a higher frequency where the dust signal is much stronger.
And so this is dust in our galaxy, which could mimic itself as the signal that you're trying to detect.
Yeah, I mean, I would put it a little differently. I would say that dust polarized emission definitely contributes some of the signal that we're seeing. The question is how much, right? Just a bit of it, half of it, most of it, it's unclear.
So at the time, how did you put an estimate of the contribution from the dust?
Using models which were already in existence from people that have specialized in making such models of foreground emission, in this case particularly dust emission, those models were not entirely unconstrained by data, but they didn't have the crucial input of real polarized measurements at 350 gigahertz, which is now coming soon from Planck.
So you're tenderly waiting this data release from Planck again?
Yes, us and everybody else.
Everyone else. You mentioned in your talk that there was some work that you as a collaboration are also doing to try and find out whether this is dust or real cosmological signal.
Yeah, so in our paper that we put out in March, we already had an attempt to constrain the so-called spectral index, basically whether or not the signal is CMB-like or dust-like in terms of how its brightness varies as you change the frequency at which you're making the observations. Now, that constraint was based on previous data at a different frequency from the previous BICEP-1 experiment. Now, that data is not very sensitive, and right now, with our current experiment, which is called Keck Array, we are taking additional data at that 100 gigahertz frequency, and we plan to be able to say something to improve that spectral index constraint really pretty soon, within a few months. We're not promising it, but we're working as hard on it as we can.
So you have this data at 150 gigahertz, and the CMB, you hope, is nice and strong there, and if I'm getting this right, so the dust would be lower at 100 than you'd expect the CMB to be.
That's right. So the dust is bright at high frequency and getting fainter as you go down in frequency. So if we look at 100 gigahertz and we see basically the same sky pattern and with a brightness ratio that matches the expectation from CMB, that's evidence against dust. If we were to see a much fainter sky pattern, that would be indicative of dust. So, That's another way. So either one can use the 350 maps from Planck to constrain, is it CMB or is it dust?
Because the 350 is only dust.
Well, 350 dust ought to be pretty dominant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Or you can go down in frequency and do basically the same game. And that's what we're trying to do with our own data that's being taken right now.
Is there any reason why there'd be some other contribution that would rise as you go down in frequency?
Yeah, I mean, there's another phenomenon called synchrotron emission, which is dominant at low frequencies. So if you go down to, say, 20 gigahertz, it's the dominant thing on the sky. That synchrotron emission, I mean, we actually have maps of it from the WMAP, the previous space experiment. There are actual downloadable maps at 23 gigahertz. They don't have as much sensitivity as one might like, but nevertheless, using those, we have convinced ourselves, and hopefully now others, that the synchrotron component of what we're seeing is negligible, right? So it's really not a problem.
Well, it's pretty exciting that you've got you have a signal which is definitely on the sky, and there's some question as to whether it's dust or this mythical, well, hopefully not mythical, gravitational waves.
Yeah. No, it's a super exciting time.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.